Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Walt, who is the Robert and Rene Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy. And he also co-wrote with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Walt.
Nice to be with you, Ian.
And there's an article or a blog by David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, that's getting a lot of attention. Hillary is running a dispatch from the Saban Forum. The Saban Forum took place in Washington a few days ago, three-day conference with a lot of senior Israeli officials, including the foreign minister, Lieberman, who was interviewed on stage by NPR's Robert Siegel. And it's a love fest that Hillary and company and the Israeli lobby are having. And the suggestion is that she's running for president. And I guess, is this the first step in running for president?
Well, certainly when I read the transcript of her remarks, my first conclusion I came to was that it was exactly that, that this is the first step in at least preparing the ground for a possible run in 2016. And certainly she was not going to do or say anything that might undermine her chances down the road. You know, she may want to take some time to think this through, and a lot can happen in the next 4 years. But I think it was a speech and, in fact, indeed an event that shows you just how unusual and in some respects unhealthy the current U.S.-Israeli relationship is, both unhealthy for the United States, but as Remnick, I think, makes clear, although he does it rather indirectly, is also not healthy for Israel either.
But it is extraordinary, is it not, that if you want to run for president of the United States, your first priority is, in effect, to start with Jerusalem.
Well, certainly, if you're Hillary, you're going to want to make sure that you have solid support from the so-called Israel lobby. And, you know, Chaim Sabin, who is the founder of the Sabin Center at the Brookings Institution and is also, I believe, still the single largest donor to the Democratic Party over the last 10 years or so, you want to make sure that you have that kind of support lined up in advance. And as you say, her speech, which was on the record, is something of a love fest. It repeats most of the usual Israeli talking points about the peace process, blames the lack of progress almost entirely on the Palestinians, was extraordinarily gentle, sort of chided the Israelis that maybe they should be somewhat more generous, and spoke, of course, with great warmth about all of her personal contacts and personal gratitude to Israeli officials and also to Mr. Sabin himself. So it was an event designed, I think, to solidify her credentials there. Unfortunately, of course, this was happening immediately after Israel had announced it was going to build a whole new series of settlements in an area known as E1, which will further bifurcate any possible Palestinian state and, again, puts the two-state solution that the United States proclaims as its goal even further out of reach than ever.
Well, Dr. Stephen Walt, it does seem extraordinary, though, that this very right-wing foreign minister, Lieberman, from a former bouncer from Moldova in the former USSR, was given such kid-glove treatment. And he, of course, lives in a settlement. And it does seem that this announcement of these new settlements is something of a poke in the eye to the president, is it not? I mean, this is longstanding U.S. policy, and yet every now and then, Israel decides to go ahead and defy the world, and they've just done it again.
That's right. And, of course, President Obama has been poked in the eye numerous times since he became president. And remember, he began in 2009 by saying, if we're going to have a peace process, it ought to begin with a halt to the settlements so we can negotiate an agreement once and for all. And, of course, that was completely rejected by the Israelis, and they've done a number of other things subsequently to poke him. Whenever that happens, a spokesman goes out, says that this is contrary to U.S. policy, that that we think it's not helpful and not constructive, but nothing further happens. It's we offer some meaningless words and then do nothing. At this point, there's no reason to think the Netanyahu government has any respect for what the Obama administration might do. And I think those who might have believed that the United States would finally get serious in an Obama second term are now discovering that that's not going to be the case. And if Hillary does run for president in 2016 and she does get elected, she will then get to deal with this problem because it won't have been solved. It will just have gotten worse.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, who is a Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and he co-wrote with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. The Remnick article at The New Yorker, again, he attended this private function, the Sabam Forum, 3 days of conference in Washington, D.C. over this weekend. And many of the top Israeli officials, including the foreign minister, spoke. What was interesting, though, that the only dissident voice in this love fest was the former Likud Prime Minister Olmert, who really went after Netanyahu. I mean, he's turning out to be, even though he's been somewhat disgraced with convictions, etc., in Israeli politics, which often the political battles often extend into the courts, it seems. But it does seem that he's actually, you know, standing up and basically saying that Netanyahu is a disaster for Israel.
Well, this is a position, by the way, that is not new for Olmert. He's been saying things like this since he was prime minister. Back in 2007, he gave a famous interview to Haaretz newspaper in Israel where he said that if the two-state solution fails, Israel's future is bleak. It will face a long-term struggle for political rights similar to what happened in South Africa. And then he went on to say that if that ever happens, the state of Israel's finished. So he's been sounding the alarm on this front. The problem, as Remnick's very important article makes clear, is that Olmert doesn't have really any following in Israel now. He's not personally popular. He doesn't lead a large and popular party. And the real problem here is it's not just Netanyahu. It's not just Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister. It's the entire direction that Israeli domestic politics is going. Remnick talks about how Israeli politics has become quite dysfunctional, even perhaps more dysfunctional than American politics, if that's possible. But the other issue is that the Israeli political opinion has been drifting steadily rightward. There really isn't a powerful peace movement in Israel any longer, and there's no immediate consequences for that because the United States will continue to support them no matter what they do. The result of which is that ultimately they will end up with one state, and then they'll have the problem of eventually the Palestinian population under their control will be a majority. And this is the future that Olmert is warning against, but there's no political consensus in Israel to do anything about it, and there's no political consensus here in the United States to try and encourage that process in any meaningful way. I think that's why you get him get Olmert being increasingly concerned about this and increasingly outspoken. But what you don't hear is a way of solving the problem.
Well, that's pretty extraordinary, though. It feels like back to the future here, that Dr. Stephen Walt, that my understanding is that the two-state solution, starting with the Oslo Accords, was largely pushed for, and I remember at the time talking to a lot of senior Israeli generals and intelligence people. They were the ones that pushed the two-state solution along with the Yitzhak Rabin in the first place, not out of any altruism towards the Palestinians, but out of an understanding that the demographic time bomb was ticking, and then unless there were two states, Israel would be overwhelmed demographically by the Palestinians. So here we are, and I don't understand. What do you think is Netanyahu and the right wing? And, you know, you're correct in suggesting, and Remnick does in the article, that the Israeli electorate has moved far to the right. And in fact, former President Bill Clinton said that this is a result of the emigration from the former Soviet Union, and that Israel, you know, its political center has changed forever and it's gone rightward. What is Netanyahu's thinking? What is their end game?
I'm not sure they have an end game. I mean, certainly Netanyahu's objective is to deny the Palestinians any meaningful statehood. That's been his clear position throughout his political career. He would like Israel to control all of Mandate Palestine, all of the West Bank. And he finally, in 2009, conceded that there might they might allow the existence of a sort of quasi-state, a series of independent Palestinian communities that would be completely surrounded by Israeli territory, completely under Israeli control. And that if the Palestinians maybe someday agreed to that, we could call it a state. But this is not a meaningful statehood. This is just apartheid by another name. The problem is I don't know what Netanyahu sees as the long-term blueprint or how you get there, how you avoid the problem that Olmert and others have pointed to. And therefore you have what I regard as a tragedy in the making, where basically it will be impossible to sustain a democratic and Jewish state in all of Mandate Palestine, and yet it will also be impossible to create two states for two peoples, which has been the stated objective. And sooner or later, the United States is going to have to confront the fact that what it has declared to be its goal, two states for two peoples, is simply no longer possible. But we're not at that point yet, which is why, again, Hillary Clinton can stand up in front of the Sabin Forum and say what she said without recognizing that that's probably an outdated view and one that is not going to be tenable for too much longer.
And one that she will inherit, a worsening situation.
Might. If she were at some point down the road to become president, then, you know, having helped kick the can down the road another 4 years, she will be facing an even more difficult set of challenges.
And at this Saban Forum over the weekend in Washington, D.C., that David Remnick writes about in The New Yorker, Hillary is running a dispatch from the Saban Forum. Apparently, the only Palestinian voice there was Salam Fayyad, the prime minister of the Palestinian Authority. And, of course, the Palestinian Authority have just been castrated, if that's possible, to multiple castrations. I'm not sure that that's medically possible, but it feels that that's what's happened to the Palestinian Authority. They've been made almost entirely irrelevant. And now the political shift inside Palestine is moving towards Hamas, even though they're essentially religious fundamentalists and zealots, as the word Hamas means, a zealot or zeal. They're making the authority even more irrelevant. What's the point of the Palestinian Authority now?
Well, I think there's two ways to view it. One is that this is simply a short-sighted policy on Israel's part, that they, with the Oslo Accords, they finally had a legitimate set of Palestinian leaders who were willing to make peace. They wanted to bargain over what that peace would be like, as anyone would, but they had accepted Israel's right to exist. And, of course, Israel was far stronger, so it was in a position where it could grant the Palestinians a state of their own and then live in peace. That didn't work. And instead, over the next now almost 20 years, the number of Israeli settlers more than doubled, so that there are now over 500,000 Israelis living in the territory that is supposed to be part of a Palestinian state. The result of that, of course, has been to completely discredit the Palestinian Authority. If 20 years of trying to reach a peaceful settlement doesn't work, and the settlements keep growing, what's the point? And that inevitably strengthens extremists on the other side. So one argument would be the Israelis have just been very short-sighted. A second argument, and it's more cynical, would be that this is actually something they're not unhappy about. That in fact, although they don't much like Hamas, particularly now, having Hamas as the enemy makes it easier to rally American support, makes it more likely that the Europeans won't put a lot of pressure on them, that in a sense, having a very weak Palestinian Authority and a very dangerous, or what looks dangerous, Hamas bogeyman is perfect because it allows the settlement project to continue. The reason why that is also short-sighted is that it ultimately doesn't do anything about the larger demographic problem that Israel faces as long as it continues to control the West Bank and as long as it continues to exert what is in effect de facto control over Gaza.
Well, the origins of Hamas are somewhat peculiar because I think it was Shin Bet, the Israeli equivalent of the FBI, that was secretly funded Hamas in the beginning as a hedge against Arafat and the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, back then. So I don't know how much of their fingerprints are over Hamas. Obviously, they are mortal enemies. But is that a continuation of that kind of cynical policy that this is almost like, you know, buying a guard dog as a puppy and it's a sweet little thing. And then when it grows up, you know, it becomes the master and you become the servant. And this is the monster that's gotten out of control.
Well, I think what it reflects is a failure to realize that Israel's own interests have changed. Back when Israel was being founded, when Zionism was first underway, or even for many years after Israel was founded, it was in Israel's interest, in at least the short term, to promote Palestinian disunity, to keep the Palestinians divided, quarreling amongst themselves, not allow strong, competent leaders to emerge. Because they might cause more trouble for Israel. Once the Palestinians had accepted Israel's existence, which again Yasser Arafat did with the Oslo Accords, then it was in fact in Israel's interest to start building up a competent, legitimate, popular authority within the Palestinian population, to do everything it could to strengthen the people who had accepted Israel's existence and to marginalize the extremists. And I think the Israeli government, you could even argue the Israeli political system broadly defined, never made that big conceptual shift, that shift away from constantly wanting to keep the Palestinians divided to a situation where you actually wanted to strengthen them. Because if you really were interested in two states for two peoples, you would want the Palestinian state next door to be very well run, very well governed, with a popular, legitimate authority that knew how to manage things. And I'm afraid that the only thing the Israelis have really been interested in has been a Palestinian security force that would keep order in the West Bank so they didn't have to do it, but not in allowing a truly strong, capable, legitimate Palestinian leadership and political community to emerge. And I think, again, that's unfortunately short-sighted, and we see it, the difficulties being manifest all the time.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Stephen Wald, you know, the former Israeli Likud Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who was the only dissident voice at this Saban Center love fest that David Remnick writes about in The New Yorker, critical of Netanyahu and of Israel's direction, and particularly making the analogy with it between Israel and South Africa, which is something that the Israelis really do not like to hear. There is an analogy, though, isn't there? There's never been a Palestinian Mandela, and I think you're right in suggesting that that's not what the Israelis wanted ever. But that's what the situation really requires now. And we know from the South African example that the short-sighted attitude of the Afrikaners in maintaining apartheid way after the historical clock made it acceptable has led to the very problems that South Africa had. You know, a whole generation of young Africans weren't educated because they were in rebellion. And I see a lot of analogies there with you've got a whole generation of young Palestinians which is in effect, it's a young state anyway, demographically, that are unemployed and angry. I mean, you know, but a lot of people have said that America's policy towards Israel is a policy of assisted suicide, and I'm afraid it looks that way.
Yeah, I think that, you know, ironically, when to just take this back full circle, what Hillary Clinton was doing at the Sabin Center was attempting to present herself as a great friend of the Jewish state. And I think unintentionally, of course, speeches like hers and the general policy of benevolent tolerance is ultimately not an act of friendship. That if you feel a friend is headed on the wrong path, you should be doing everything in your power to try and get them off that path and onto a better one. And by essentially serving as the enabler for a set of policies that we claim to object to, the United States, and in this case the Secretary of State, was not acting like a true friend.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Stephen Wald.
Nice talking with you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Wald, who is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Origins of Alliance, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy. And he also co-wrote with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and answer some of your questions of late. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.